Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Today's program, we focus on the state of the news media as we engage in discussion about the role of critical media literacy education as a pathway to social justice. Please stay with us. But my people getting tired of the pain and the shame. We're not commodities or cogs that turn the global economy. We're the promise of a legacy, a spirit we're honoring. An anomaly to those who can't imagine a world without oppressive forces slain before almighty dollar bills. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. On today's program, it's the state of the news media as we engage in discussion about the role of critical media literacy education as a pathway to social justice. Here's Peter to introduce our guests to you.
Rob Williams is a professor of media, global studies, and communications in Burlington, Vermont area. He teaches at the University of Vermont, Champlain College, and St. Michael's College. He's authored numerous articles on critical media literacy, education, and lectures around the world. He's currently the board co-president of the Action Coalition for Media Education. His most recent book, he served as co-editor, is Media Education for Digital Generation. Joining us also on the air is Robin Anderson. She's a professor and director of graduate studies, Department of Communications and Media Studies at Fordham University. She also directs the Peace and Justice Studies program. Her book, A Century of Media, A Century of War, won the Alpha Sigma Nu Book Award for 2007. She's an author of dozens of other books and journal articles. Robin, welcome.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
And Rob, welcome as well.
Thank you, Peter.
We're doing critical media analysis and social justice. Robin, what does social justice mean to you?
Well, in terms of critical media literacy, it seems like giving students the tools and the knowledge and the critical perspective by which to understand their own situation in the larger social and economic world, to understand how they fit in and why the world is filled with inequality, and many times students feel it very profoundly.
Rob Williams, this is Mickey Huff on the Project Censored Show. Let's take the same question to you. Let's just to get an outline here about how do you see social justice and its connection with critical media literacy, particularly given your work with ACME?
Thanks, Mickey. I see social justice as really starting with media justice. Media are storytelling environments. We, as human beings, we're storytelling creatures. It's what we do. And I think so much of the stories that are told in our corporate commercial media culture, influenced by the power, of course, of big governments and intelligence agencies and such, the stories that we tell in our media culture, I think, are fundamentally unjust at so many levels. So to square media, our media stories, with social justice, I think, is a huge task for media literacy educators in the 21st century.
Well, Rob Williams, not long ago, there was a major conference, a summit with the Action Coalition for Media Education, ACME. Project Censored were co-sponsors of that. You worked, however, closely with the people at Sacred Heart University. That would be Bill Usman, Lori Bindig. They have a graduate program there, the only one of its type in the United States. It's on media literacy and digital culture. Project Censored, of course, was there, part of that. It was a fantastic weekend. But, you know, again, what do you think we take out of this? You know, there was a big focus on media literacy there, and I think a big focus on the crossover with various social justice movements. Could you tell our listeners just a little bit about what came out of that?
Sure. Yeah, it was a powerful meeting. There are close to 100 people there from all over the country, all of them interested in media education in some way. And the conversations ran the gamut from gender misrepresentation and racial misrepresentation in media to grassroots media production to empowering young people to tell stories about their own lives and their own communities. And it was a really rich conversation. If you define media literacy broadly as the power to access, analyze, evaluate, and produce stories or produce media, then there is a really rich kind of cross-section of activities around those four action verbs on display at the summit. And I think everyone who attended the summit, at least the folks I listened to and talked with, walked away feeling like they had a chance to share their own work with folks in the room, but also, I think, learn from the approaches and the techniques and the pedagogy of others. And it was pretty cool. It was pretty empowering. And it was great to have Project Censored at the table representing grassroots approach to media watchdogging and the validated independent news process, which I know your listeners are probably familiar with.
Hey, Rob, tell us a little bit about ACME. Action Coalition for Media Education, the history, and your development.
There are about 40 media educators in 2002 who founded the Action Coalition for Media Education as an alternative, actually, to another national media literacy education that was emerging at that time that was taking money, taking funding from large media corporations, big media, as we like to say. And a number of us around the country were pretty disappointed in that organizational decision, and we felt like we did not want the U.S. media education movement coming out of the gate 15 years ago to be co-opted right away by big media corporations. So we created our own organization called ACME, and one of our founding principles in our mission statement is that we do not accept any funding from big media corporations. So that's a clear distinction, I think, between ACME and other media education as it's practiced in North America, is that particular distinction. Another one would be, I think, the emphasis on the media portion of media literacy. Literacy is about teaching people how to critically read and write. Media literacy is about looking at the political economy of media, looking at how media organizations are structured economically and politically, how decisions are made, who gets to play and not play, who's included and excluded in those decisions. So we really bring a structural analysis to our work as well as a message-centered analysis, and media literacy is a term that captures both of those. And if you put the word critical in front of it, I think it makes even more sense, critical media literacy. So we've been hosting summits around the country now. This was our sixth one at Sacred Heart University since 2002. We're at an exciting time for the organization where we're building out new partnerships, particularly around this global critical media literacy project with Project Censored and other partners, and I think we'll get into that more in just a bit.
Rob, I remember specifically how Disney was funding media literacy a dozen years ago. You know, and it was basically watch more and think about these things. And that's kind of how that originated. So ACME, Action Coalition for Media Education, has a far more critical approach and a way of looking at what's happening in the world. Robin, you just wrote a piece for Common Dreams that is entitled The Clinton Plan, Defeat Sanders and Unify the Democratic Party. You were doing critical media analysis of that. Tell us what you think.
I think teaching students to take a real critical perspective on any topic, and certainly this year's election is a prime example for that, because as Rob says, the narratives and the stories we tell really inform what's happening. And oftentimes we just think that these stories are seamless and they're therefore quite influential. But what my piece in Common Dreams tried to show was how the Clinton campaign is very good at strategy and tactics to shape the press with their talking points, and the press picks them up. So, for example, when Bernie Sanders wins Wisconsin and by double digits, the following morning, it was really all about picking up the Clinton campaign talking points, which were that Bernie's now going negative. And that was the direct memo that was sent out on Tuesday night, the night of the primary, and sent out across the media to claim that Clinton was now going to challenge Bernie's qualifications. Since Clinton has such high negatives, she couldn't be the one to say it. So my piece was about how they use surrogates within the campaign to say it, but Clinton would never say it. So when Bernie then says Clinton is being negative and he's trying to disqualify our campaign, then what the media did is all of the stories through Wednesday were Bernie's attacking Clinton. Bernie claims that Hillary Clinton is trying to disqualify her, claims that she's unqualified to be the president. So it tells you the distraction of the media, how the narratives are really kind of contrived and constructed behind the scenes.
And Robin Anderson, this is originally published at FAIR, to be fair, right? Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. It was republished at Common Dreams.
Right.
Your article is An Unqualified Success at Media Manipulation. So if listeners want to find it, they can go to FAIR.org. If they want to learn more about ACME, I just figured I would insert now. SmartMediaEducation.net is the place you can find out more about that online. And Robin Anderson, you've, of course, been involved with ACME. You've been involved as a national judge with Project Censored. Media literacy circles are particularly critical media circles, right? Our media literacy circles are tight ones at that. So we tend to work with each other on these types of important issues. And you're at Fordham University. So could you tell our listeners a little bit about how you go about doing these kind of things in the classroom as a model for how, you don't need to be in a classroom to do this kind of thing is what I'm getting at. So could you tell us a little bit about some of the things you do in the classroom to link media literacy and social justice concerns?
Well, first of all, we kind of really look at the narratives of what mainstream media, and they don't have to be news. They can certainly be entertainment, everything from blockbuster films to advertising. And the first step is to do a critical evaluation of what the message actually is trying to say and look at the foundational undergirdings of what that narrative is based upon. So when we have, for example, all of the action-adventure films now featuring military weaponry and active valor, which previewed 9 active duty SEALs on the war on terror, by showing them behind-the-scenes deals that are made between the Pentagon and the producers of the films, we try to understand that these are very militarized narratives, and these militarized pro-war narratives have everything to do with the way the United States allocates its budget, with over 60% going to the military, and how we don't ever challenge the military budget. Now there's an idea that shouldn't we audit the military, but it's kind of outrageous that we haven't done that so far. So it's kind of behind the scenes. It's analyzing the narratives themselves and understanding the influence that they have on our opinions. What I like to say is that all kind of social justice issues are media issues. And what I find when you teach students that this is where your stereotypes come from, this is how these narratives affect you, what happens is the kind of wool comes away from their eyes, and they understand how they hold their own set of opinions, and then that's how it works.
Rob Williams, let's take a look at what's happening recently in Syria. We now have B-52s dropping tons and tons of bombs rather indiscriminately across the country. It's reminiscent of Vietnam, where millions of people died, mostly civilians. What kind of a critical media approach would you take to this in the classroom addressing war and peace in Syria and what's going on today?
Yeah, it's funny. I start off by asking my students if they know how many U.S. air raids have been flown over Syria in the past 18 months to 24 months. And, of course, they don't, because it's not at all covered in the U.S. corporate commercial press. And when I tell them that it's literally thousands of bombing campaigns daily, sometimes several times a day, it's kind of an eye-opener for them. So just start with some basic facts about what we know about U.S. military activity in Syria and then unpack it from there. The ultimate irony when you connect the presidential campaign rhetoric around Syria with what's actually happening is you have this very strange and bizarre and sort of disturbing alternate reality where the U.S. military is destroying a country and creating so many refugees and then refusing in many cases to even take these refugees in. It's really sort of macabre. And so I think the place to start is by asking some basic factual questions about what's happening in Syria currently and then working back with the history of the region. And this requires, some journalistic questions. It requires some history, some geographies, some global studies knowledge. But begin with questions. Begin with critical questions and then work your way from there.
Robin Anderson, over to you.
Another way is to use this election campaign as a launch pad into certain kinds of teaching moments. For example, the last Democratic debate between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. Hillary Clinton actually blamed President Obama for the kind of debacle in Libya, in which really Hillary Clinton was the one who really pressured Obama as the Secretary of State to take Gaddafi out as the head of Libya. And what happens, of course, was the repercussions through North Africa and the Middle East once Gaddafi was no longer in power, and the guns that poured into Syria and to Boko Haram in Nigeria, the destabilizing of Mali and Chad, which really helped to lead to the bombings in Paris. So the news media seems to be singularly incapable of correcting the record many times during these debates. And the example is always that nobody really cares in a presidential debate about foreign policy. But I find once you start talking about that, that is not true, that students are keenly interested in the refugees and in the situation in the Middle East. And one more thing about the refugees and their children have been put kind of on the face of the UNHCR and a lot of donation appeals. And I have friends in the United Nations Alliance of Civilization who really focuses on media literacy and really targeting children. And what they say is, look, children are used in all kinds of ways, but let's now give them some media skills whereby they can tell their own stories. And the Alliance of Civilization has a wonderful website called Plural Plus where they take videos, short videos made by children from around the world, and they have this big festival. And it's quite exciting to see what children actually produce.
Well, Robin Anderson, we're going to follow up with more of that kind of, not just like a citizen journalism, but grassroots journalism. And Rob Williams, you were mentioning the importance of storytelling. We're going to take a brief break here. And when we come back, we'll welcome in Nolan Higdon to the discussion. We're talking about critical media literacy education and social justice. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. This is the Project Censored Show. We'll be back after this brief musical break. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. On today's show, we're talking about the role of critical media literacy education as a pathway to social justice. We've been speaking with Dr. Robin Anderson of Fordham University. We've also been talking to Dr. Rob Williams, co-president of the Action Coalition for Media Education. That's smartmediaeducation.net. We now want to welcome Professor Nolan Higdon to the conversation. Some listeners may recall Nolan Higdon works with Project Censored. He's sometimes a guest co-host. He sits on the board of the Media Freedom Foundation and ACME, as well as he is the coordinator for the Global Critical Media Literacy Project. That's a joint effort between Project Censored, ACME, Sacred Heart University. So, Nolan Higdon, welcome to the conversation.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
So, we're speaking about critical media literacy. We're talking about pathways to social justice. How do you see this new joint endeavor, this Global Critical Media Literacy Project, how do you see that fitting in to this media literacy education role as it's connecting to things like social justice?
Social justice education starts by having educators actually recognize inequities in society and using the classroom as a way to ameliorate those problems. That's why the GCMLP emphasizes the service learning model. So students are not just, you know, producing content for the sake of getting it graded, but it's content that's consumed by the public. And the idea is to inform and offer solutions and test potential solutions for societal problems. So there's something a little deeper to the classroom than just getting graded work. but actually trying to be a part of transforming the society to be better.
So tell us about the kinds of assignments that you are going to be doing in the classroom. Again, you say this is not only for the classroom, and we mentioned that earlier in the program, kind of how to model things in the classroom and take them out into the to the so-called real world. What kind of things do you find useful in terms of critical media literacy education and social justice?
Rob Manderson had mentioned earlier, informing students that all this information and entertainment they consume, even if they think it's trivial and they don't necessarily go to it to inform them, it does inform them, and it does in some ways manipulate their understanding of events and people, cultures, individuals, stories. So Robin had mentioned representation issues. You know, entertainment does inform a lot of people the way they see other groups, and it often can serve to justify the marginalization of other groups. So an important thing in the classroom, one of the exercises we do is going through with students, looking at different entertainment shows and pulling out the stereotypes they see. So what are the limits, for example, that like an Asian actor could play? Which parts are they able to play? Which parts do they never play? What is the racial or class makeup of the central focus characters? So those type of questions to kind of see how society kind of constructs this false image through entertainment. We also do a lot of the Project Censored book work as well. So we do things like junk food and news abuse. So we have students, you know, go look at corporate media and find a news story that is non-newsworthy and find out which dates it was covered. Go to the independent media for those same dates and find a story that is newsworthy that the corporate media didn't cover. So we see how the corporate media covers these trivial, often meaningless stories at the expense of these stories that have some meaning to community and a larger society.
Nolan, I have my students in all my classes subscribe to independent media and bring stories to class related to our topics. Our social justice, we cover all kinds of things, war and peace, of course, the police state, Black Lives Matter, environmental concerns. What are some of your favorite independent news sources that you have students look at?
There's very many. One of the questions I often get from students is, you know, where do you get your news? And generally they I think come with that question, hoping that I'll give them the one website where they can find everything they need now. And I tell them that, generally speaking, independent media does a better job than corporate media, but every single outlet has some weaknesses and some strengths. So you start to figure out who has journalists that are more apt to report foreign policy, who are better reporting on economic policy, racial problems, class problems. So there's many. Off the top of my head, I would say things like Think Progress and Truth Out. Common Dreams is always great. So those are some of the ones that I check daily for sure.
Robin Anderson, let's come back to you. You write for Common Dreams, but what are some other independent news sources that you favor and think that students should be watching and reading?
I think U.S. Uncut has some very good stories. I think in terms of online YouTube sources, The Young Turks often has some pretty good analysis. In terms of surveillance and some of the other issues of our day, The Intercept is also very good, in addition to Common Dreams, which I think is fine.
Robin Anderson, given your experience in education and your experience working with many different groups, what do you see specifically? Let's bring in a little more of the critical analysis here, of course, with things like the propaganda model from Noam Chomsky, Edward Herman. How do you help students understand corporate ownership, right? Because at Project Censored, we don't say mainstream media very often. We say corporate or corporate mainstream to be more descriptive, because six companies own 90% of it. So that's not really a mainstream platform. How do you get this across, the idea of ownership and advertising? I mean, this is all happening. Our media system is part of capitalism. It's really the elephant in the room, but it's impossible to talk about being critically media literate in an educational process without mentioning that capitalist angle.
Right, and I think this current election has given us many examples by which to make those connections between ownership and, in this case, donors. For example, Carlos Slim, who is the chairman and CEO of Telmex, and he's also the largest New York Times shareholder, I think really explains why the New York Times came out and supported Hillary Clinton and why, and, you know, if we just take one really interesting example of Bernie Sanders going to Rome and talking about a moral economy, no matter who you're for, that deserves a kind of a simple descriptive kind of narrative of the kind the Guardian did and things like that. But the New York Times called it a Roman holiday when Bernie Sanders met the Pope. They called it a coveted souvenir. So much of the behind-the-scenes manipulation of the press frame for this election, that of the very sophisticated analysis of the Clinton campaign has accomplished, is also largely due to the donors, and the media organizations are very much part of that process. So CNN has, you know, been called by many the kind of spokesperson for Hillary Clinton, and Time Warner, the parent company, donated $400,000.
I'm on the opensecrets.org right now, and it says here Time Warner has contributed over $600,000 total to the Hillary Clinton campaign. There's some very interesting lists at opensecrets.org about donors, but Time Warner is the parent company for CNN.
So we see how these conglomerates change, and at the top, the very reason we call them corporate media, because they're highly conglomerated and centralized, filters down through all kinds of press and media coverage.
Nolan Higdon, let's bring you back in here for a moment. And the same idea, how do you find it effective to get people to understand how ownership and advertising and the reliance, particularly on official sources, right? So on the one hand, we have the reliance upon only official sources or establishment voices. On the other hand, we get the frequent ghost kind of citation, the some people say type of issue. So what, how do you deal with those things?
This is why adding the critical perspective is so important. I mean, not just teaching media literacy, but critical media literacy, because a critical perspective allows you to examine and question issues of power. Who has power to create the media? Whose voice are the strongest? Who's constructed? For what purpose? So that critical perspective is really important. Just like you're talking about there with Time Warner, it allows you to bring in this economic model where candidates are purchased, and those candidates who are chosen to serve the needs of those in power are championed on news broadcasts and online websites, and others are not. For example, the Washington Post ran 16 negative ads against Bernie Sanders in 16 hours. As Robin was pointing out, too, the New York Times pulled out what they called liberal economists, but some weren't economists and others weren't liberal, to attack Bernie's economic plan. But again, when you have nobody sort of challenging that inside the corporate press, you can get away with it. But a critical media literacy education would not only point out these problems to students, but question the motives behind them. So who has the power to do this? What is the purpose of doing this? Who does it serve? Why do they want this? So I would say that in the classroom, that critical perspective is huge to question these power dynamics. And conversely, in something like Black Lives Matter has not endorsed a candidate. So while the corporate press is talking about Hillary taking in the votes from African Americans and Bernie supposedly not doing so well, the critical perspective would ask a larger question, like, are any of these candidates actually speaking to the needs of the African American community in the United States?
Well, Nolan Higdon, I wanted to get back to the joint efforts of the Global Critical Media Literacy Project, and the website is gcml.org. And, you know, based on the kinds of things that we've just been talking about here, how, again, do you see this moving forward, and what do you hope to accomplish here?
For the last about 20 years in the United States, we've seen the Department of Education and a lot of supposed experts get involved and try to push our education toward this more neoliberal, individualistic, test-taking agenda. And we're hoping to be an antidote to that problem. We'd like to see teachers in the classroom working for societal problems, talking about inequities, championing a social justice agenda. And if these schools are not facilitating that type of growth, we'd like to create a network of students, faculty, activists, advocates who build this network where they're able to foster professional development to help faculty teach this type of education in the classroom.
Nolan Higdon is a professor of English and history at several colleges in the San Francisco Bay Area. He sits on the board of ACME, the Action Coalition for Media Education, as well as Media Freedom Foundation. He's the coordinator of the Global Critical Media Literacy Project, gcml.org. Nolan Higdon, thank you for joining the program today. I'm sure we'll certainly continue this conversation in the future.
Thank you all. Great hearing from all of you.
I'd like to remind listeners, you're listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We'll continue our conversation with Rob Williams and Robin Anderson after this brief musical break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. On today's program, we're talking about the role of critical media literacy education, pathways to social justice. We're joined by educators. We're joined by Professor Rob Williams and Dr. Robin Anderson, both veterans of media literacy movements. Rob Williams is co-president of the Action Coalition for Media Education. Robin Anderson is a longtime writer of media literacy. She's a Project Censored judge. She's at Fordham University. You know, we've been talking about this issue for a while, and I wanted to switch around and maybe talk about a different frame. And I know Peter wants to talk a little bit about this particular subject. So, Peter?
All of our military adventures worldwide today are justified under the idea of a war on terror. And that certainly manifested itself after 9/11, but was used somewhat even before that. But, Rob Williams, how do you understand the mantra war on terror as a justification, and how do you have students address that?
Most of my students are familiar with the Cold War between the Soviet Union and the United States. And an easy way to sort of enter into the conversation is to simply say, look, for 50 years, communism was demonized as the ultimate enemy of U.S. freedom and democracy, capitalism. And when the Soviet Union collapsed and the Berlin Wall fell, U.S. military and political elites needed a new demon. And terrorism has provided the U.S. military-industrial complex with a really wonderful demon, because terrorism is not something you can really identify at the end of the day. Terrorism is kind of a loose and nebulous concept that can be leveraged in anyone and is leveraged in any one of a number of ways to justify U.S. military action, not just all around the world, but now in outer space as well, as the Pentagon pursues its goal of full-spectrum dominance. So I think that's a helpful analogy for students to compare terrorism of today with communism during the Cold War as a rhetorical propaganda tool, if you will, to justify U.S. military action.
Robin Anderson, how do you deal with the idea of a war on terror in your classrooms?
Following from what Rob just said, I go on to talk about how the invasion of Iraq in 2003 was justified as part of the war on terror, but there was absolutely no reason to go into Iraq in that Saddam Hussein did not have weapons of mass destruction, nor was he involved in bringing down the Twin Towers. So it is meaningful in this election campaign to talk about who really authorized that war. I like also to go on to how in this framework that war has been turned into entertainment, and that the way we're actually fighting the war now with drones is kind of the same technology designed with the research and development collaboration between the military and the armed forces and the commercial media industries, and that those same computer-based digital technologies are actually used in the weaponry that we're using and also are primarily the way in which we entertain ourselves. So I think those are very kind of powerful tropes when we start trying to educate students on everything about the military.
Robin Anderson, let's continue on this theme, and then Rob Williams, we want to go and hit the same topic. I want to open up the can of worms of the Central Intelligence Agency and the impact on media. I mean, if you go back to the Church Committee hearings in the 70s, the Woodward Bernstein, in fact, the Bernstein article in Rolling Stone from 1977 on the CIA involvement. We know that there is this thing called the CIA Entertainment Liaison Office, and Robin Anderson, we talked about this about or surrounding the movie The Interview, and you wrote a fantastic article a year and a half ago, Sony, The Interview, and Hollywood Illusions of Creative Expression, and it's a really fantastic article. But could you talk a little bit about what's behind it? I mean, this is a real thing. Some people may start saying, oh, this sounds like a conspiracy theory, but explain to people how this kind of collusion works between the CIA and Hollywood to create propaganda in support of the war on terror.
I was kind of inspired to write that because of the brouhaha when they weren't going to air the film, and everybody said, gosh, this is a freedom of expression issue. And what I said was that the industry has kind of handed over its grips and stuff to be funded by the military, because that funding does not come without a price. And they are allowed, the military, to vet the scripts before those movies go. But that particular film, The Interview, the reason that it was the only film that ever actually portrayed taking out an actual living head of state in North Korea, it was a CIA plant, and that came out in the emails that had been hacked and the Sony executives that actually the suggestion that it should be North Korea, as the United States military was pivoting toward Asia, that's how that came about. And in that sense, let's say that the filmmakers had given up their freedom of speech a long while in advance and allowed the CIA to direct the narrative and really blow his head up and stuff like that.
Quite obscene and gratuitous in many ways. But, you know, the reason I bring that back up is because, as well, Rob Williams, you wrote a chapter for Censored 2014 called Screening the Homeland, How Hollywood Fantasy Mediates State Fascism in U.S. Empire, which was, you know, actually a really descriptive title. You talked specifically about two movies, Argo and Zero Dark Thirty, which, you know, were winning awards, and the First Lady of the United States was sort of beamed in to give the awards at the Oscars for these, you know, very pro-war narratives. It also is proven that these had connections from Central Intelligence Agency. Rob Williams, could you talk a little bit about that?
There's a long and distinguished history of CIA involvement in Hollywood at the most intimate of levels, and Robin just mentioned it as well. I mean, it runs the gamut from the Pentagon essentially sanctioning the use of military hardware in movies, Hollywood movies, in exchange for having creative access to scripts. And movies are routinely vetted and edited and tweaked and changed and seeded with CIA sort of influenced ideas and plot twists and narratives, and things are put in and removed. And the Argo Zero Dark Thirty year was particularly fun because they actually gave Ben Affleck, the director of Argo, the award from the White House as part of a televised throw from the Oscar ceremony across the country with Michelle Obama in attendance. And it was truly sort of a magical Hollywood meets the deep state meets the president sort of moment when they opened the envelope and voila, Argo had won. And then, of course, Argo is a film that creatively retells the story of the liberation of, love that word, liberation of U.S. hostages in Iran. And we could talk for a lot more about how the whole story was reinvented by the movie, but it happens all the time. CIA and Hollywood are pretty much in bed together when it comes to sort of the Hollywood film industry and, as Robin mentioned earlier, action movies and comedies, too. The Interview was sort of pitched as, you know, in some ways a comedy, which is kind of grotesque.
Pretty dark. But I think, too, this comes back to the role of critical media literacy education. And in creating a just world, we have to really have the critical thinking tools and skills to understand and deconstruct the imagery, the messages, and whether it's from pop culture or the news media. This is where critical media literacy education really is a powerful tool, I think. Rob, could you comment a little more on that?
You know, Robin touched on this earlier. I think students are really hungry to talk about this stuff in class, whether it's news or pop culture or television shows or films. And really, critical media literacy education gives not only the tools for doing so, but it gives students permission to talk about these sorts of things, because this is the culture that we're all swimming in. So when you can bring a text into the classroom and really take it apart and begin to sort of look at how it's put together and ask these critical questions and do some research, as Peter was mentioning earlier, and connect this back out to the real world. And Nolan talked about the Global Critical Media Literacy Project, and then ask students to publish critical pieces on this work that they're doing around pop culture texts that have so much influence and resonance in the culture, then we're getting some stuff done. You know, then it gets really exciting, connecting all these dots. So I think media literacy education, as Nolan alluded to, is the antidote in some ways to kind of the standards-based, test-focused mantra that we've been fed from the feds for several decades now.
Rob and Robin, I want to talk about how can we bring this to the front in a classroom situation. Jason Leopold released an audit in 2012 where they identified 22 movie projects between 2006 and 11 that the CIA had been involved in, books, movie projects, media kinds of things. But if that's ongoing, which we highly believe is, and then, you know, something comes out like the Panama release of those documents, the Panama Papers, and then the identified villains are everybody we don't like, everybody the State Department doesn't like, the CIA doesn't like, it was Putin and other people around.
How convenient, Peter, convenient.
How convenient. So immediately I'm going like, okay, where is this coming from? And of course we found out that the International Office of Investigative Journalism was funded by USAID and Ford Foundation and that. So, but when we're in the classroom and something pops up, I mean, are there steps that you can really take or that you take with students to ask critical questions?
I can jump in real quick because we actually did this when the Panama Papers was released. I put up an article the day the story broke. I had class that afternoon, and we read through the article together so students had a sense of what the Panama Papers were, you know, 2.6 terabytes of information downloaded. And then each of them generated a question that we then posted on our course blog, and then they went out and did some research and brought back their answers to the question 2 days later. And, you know, we had learned a little bit more about the story. But then we kept tracking the story and different sort of observers' critical takes on the story, and it became this kind of living laboratory, suddenly, conversation around this breaking news story. And it was pretty neat, actually, to see the students really dive in and start putting together a whole bunch of different perspectives on the story and asking these questions. So, yeah, I think that Panama Papers is a great example of how you can take a breaking news story and turn it into a critical media literacy exercise.
Robin Anderson, let's bring you back in on the same issue. And again, it isn't just the Panama Papers, which are revealing a lot of offshore tax havens with just unbelievable amounts of money. Can you comment a little bit more about that? Rob and Peter were just talking about, well, what's behind this? And how do you see this kind of foundation funding and USAID and these types of things? How does that also maybe paint or taint or slant or move the direction of a leak of this nature? What's your view on that?
You know, Mickey, I like to approach it from a theoretical perspective and talk about media studies and cultural studies in general and kind of point how the media is connected to all kinds of different area studies, and that the larger issue of our culture of a pro-business model, of a pro-investment model, of living, if you will, under the tyranny of a corporate media system where, for example, you get the CEO of CBS saying Trump may be bad for America, but he sure is good for CBS. And in this kind of pro-investment, return on investment type of capitalism and under which we live, we don't bring it down to the everyday level of how this affects our lives in every way. What are the consequences of money gravitating to the 0.10% so profoundly, not only in America but around the globe? And it brings in everything. It brings in environmental issues and corporate globalization everywhere, and ties into the global arms trade. And so one of my projects, I think, is to kind of point out to students that they are connected. One of the things that media doesn't do in the narratives is connect the dots between all the fragments of the narrative. And I think it's really important to try to do that sometimes and provide context for where the stories come from and where this kind of sudden dump of all of the papers and the terabytes that come from the Panama Papers.
This is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We're going to continue our conversation about the role of critical media literacy education and social justice after this brief musical break. Stay with us.
Bye.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We're joined by Robin Anderson. She's a professor at Fordham University in communications. She teaches media studies and author of numerous works on media literacy and media criticism. Dr. Rob Williams also joins us. He's from the Action Coalition of Media Education. And we're going to wrap up today's program by talking about a recent report. And this is something that I'm sure you all have something to say about. The recent report from Reporters Without Borders that ranked the U.S., well, it ranks all countries around the world, 180 countries. It ranks the level of freedom of information in 180 countries. And the U.S. was ranked 41st this year, and that's actually up from 48th last year. So we can hear the chants of we're 41, we're 41 all over. What do you make of this? For example, what do you think is behind this kind of a ranking in the U.S., particularly under the Obama administration, the war on whistleblowers and the surveillance of people? How do you see this connecting? And why is that something that we should be alarmed about, that the U.S. is ranked 41st in press freedom?
Well, Mickey and Peter, I think your incredible work at Project Censored has been, over the years, invaluable in pointing out that even though the United States exports this idea of freedom of speech around the globe and often is uses it as a hammer in other countries tied to aid and you need to, you know, get your media out from under the governments and kind of, you know, privatize it. I think that what the United States has been profoundly bad at is understanding the role of corporate censorship in the news frame and their lack of freedom of expression and speech. Just for example, we've been talking about how media literacy should be teaching students how to question social inequality and economic inequality. But our media never does that as a corporate media. And we're in an election campaign. Well, the FAIR study of the 2012 election campaign pointed out that 0.2% of campaign stories addressed poverty in any substantive way. So we're simply not talking about these kinds of stories in the U.S. mainstream press that are vitally important for our students to understand how the world works and their position within the world and how they can challenge that type of inequality.
Rob Williams, your take on that.
Yeah, that was beautifully said. And I guess I would add that we have to grapple now that we live in the United States in an empire. The U.S. has become an imperial project and has been for a while. And like all good empires or bad empires, the United States has taken steps to squash, I think, alternative visions of stories that interfere with the empire-building process and all of its manifestations. And I think journalists have suffered their casualties, I think, of this particular imperial process. And, you know, Peter Phillips is fond of talking about journalists in the United States self-censoring. They recognize a good and powerful and provocative story, but because they know that they probably can't break that story through the filters we talked about before with the propaganda model of news in their institutional matrices, there's just really no point in pursuing those stories, for example. So press freedom is quieted in so many different ways. Surveillance, you mentioned Obama's war on whistleblowers, you mentioned. And, you know, as an aside, I think some of the best investigative work being done right now, other than, of course, Project Censored, which is awesome, you could look to someone like John Oliver on HBO, who uses humor and comedy to do some really sort of hard-hitting, in his own way, investigative journalism on a whole range of social and political issues that impact ordinary people, ordinary Americans in this country. And, you know, we could list a whole bunch of other ones, too, but I've happened to be watching a lot of John Oliver lately, just kind of studying what he's up to. It's a problem when late-night comedians are some of our best truth-tellers in the journalistic community.
And they had to invent a new genre of kind of news and comedy in order to actually get around the censors.
Exactly, exactly.
Reporters Without Borders has been criticized. They're based in France, of course. They have a multi-million dollar budget. And they've been criticized for being biased in favor of European media and press. So certainly they're not U.S.-based necessarily, but they did have contracts with Otto Reich going back in 2005 in terms of being critical of Cuba. So Cuba ends up being on the bottom of their list, as do most of the countries that the State Department doesn't like. So I think that there's a built-in bias in terms of their kind of reporting. I'm not sure we can take it as clearly objective.
I think that that's important to note as well, though, by any measure, the fact that the United States is quite braggadocious about its "we're number one" kind of slogans and press freedom and so on. I mean, being ranked in the 40s is certainly not a boasting point. And in fact, after the study was published, the LA Times looked at Japan and how Japan came to rank worse than Tanzania on press freedom. And, of course, the big slide is that a few years ago they went from 11 and now they're down to 72 out of the 180 countries on the Reporters Without Borders study. And I just wondered, what was interesting to me about the article in the LA Times was that it was a pretty decent investigative piece about the media in Japan, about Japan's poor performance on press freedom, and about the rightward shift and the control of journalists. And, of course, they link this to the post-Fukushima environment. But I want to say that nowhere in the LA Times article does it say anything about the fact that the United States was ranked 41st on the same study. Robin Anderson.
Nor was there any criticism about our idea that we're supposed to be supporting democracy and our allies, that somehow they're associated with the democracy, and how Turkey, another country that we've been promoting, has one of the worst records on censorship. When I was in Turkey, you couldn't even say the word Kurd, and the kind of strange, mixed-up foreign policy, always based in the justification of democracy, yet supports the worst kind of oppressive states.
Well, indeed. And what's going on in Turkey recently? I mean, you know, edicts that you can't criticize, the head of the government. And in fact, it was trickling into Germany, where the German government was going after critics of the Turkish government. I mean, to me, it seems that there's a lot more that we could be talking about. But I mean, granted, the LA Times piece was, I believe, rightfully critical of the Japanese press. But it's quite curious that it's easy to be critical of others, but not use the same lens of analysis on ourselves. Rob Williams?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right, Mickey. I think it's a form of sort of collective cultural cognitive disconnect that the United States press, you know, is so good at leveling criticism at the very countries our U.S. government has supported for decades in really repressing citizens in other countries in the name of advancing, you know, the U.S. imperial agenda with its allies around the world. And I think you're absolutely right. It's a real travesty, and it's worth calling that out, I think, as part of our work.
Well, let's get a closing statement from each of you here. So, Robin Anderson, let's go to you with this. Again, you are professor of media studies at Fordham University. A book you did a while ago was A Century of Media, A Century of War. You have a lot of experience both in and out of the classroom working with media literacy. But the final question I have for you both, and we'll start with you, Robin Anderson. Let's take this out of the classroom again. Let's take critical media literacy education and social justice. And how do you recommend people do this kind of thing? It's part of their daily lives, people that aren't in the classroom.
Just having a discussion of what people are reading and listening to. My favorite part of the New York Times is the letter section, where you get average citizens, you know, being far more observant in their observations about what's going on than sometimes the articles. But, you know, bringing it down into the movement, I've worked for such a long time with independent producers in New York, Paper Tiger and other places. One of the missions of Paper Tiger was to take the video cameras and producers and directors into schools and other places, but even community groups and nonprofit organizations, to give people a voice, to let people begin to understand how they can speak in their own voice, and giving them the tools and the skills to allow them to represent themselves. So much of the media in our country, people around the globe, we don't hear from them in their own voice. And that's why I think to try to really support and talk about how we can empower people to speak in their own voice at any level and within community groups is the best way to kind of go about that.
Rob Williams, same question to you. You were alluding to this, I believe, with your talk of John Oliver. And what is your advice for people, you know, people that aren't in traditional classrooms? How do we become more media literate?
Robin's absolutely right. I think, you know, critical media analysis can be done by anyone. And I think analysis leads to questioning. Questioning leads to raising your voice. I love Robin's example of the letters. I love reading the letters and comments in every sort of news platform that I consume, because there's a lot of wisdom there that often goes unexpressed through the corporate commercial lens. And then finally, I think you connect those voices to movements that matter for ordinary people. And there's a whole wide range of them, as we know. And I think it's really about connecting people to those larger conversations and encouraging them to have the courage to raise their voice. You know, I think it was Julian Assange and others who have said courage is contagious. And I think it's our job as media educators to make not just our students, but you know, those around us, give them the power to feel like they can be courageous and go from there.
And all the courageous things that people with cell phones on city streets have recorded, you know, police officers killing black people, and really the Black Lives Matter movement, you know, has really been really helped by that technology and people, the courage of people to record that.
Yeah, and a great example, I think, of what we're talking about.
Well, thank you so much for joining us on the Project Censored Show today for this conversation about critical media literacy education, social justice. Rob Williams, your recent work is Media Education for a Digital Generation, edited by both you and Julie Frechette of ACME. You can learn more at smartmediaeducation.net. Robin Anderson, Media Studies Professor at Fordham, writes with Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, Project Censored Judge. Thank you for all of your important work, and thank you for joining us on the program today.
Thank you, Mickey. It was great.
Mm-hmm. We were also joined by Nolan Higdon talking about the Global Critical Media Literacy Project. We certainly thank all of our guests, and we thank you for tuning in.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, cause they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came. It's a dirty game maintained by rain for capital gain, but my people getting tired of the pain and the shame.
You're tuned to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. Special thanks go to Anthony Fest, our producer. Our engineer is Erica Bridgman. Project Censored Show airs on over 40 stations around the U.S., and archives can be found online at projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook. We'll see you next time.
Crimes perpetrated by the criminal minds, political ties, habitualized alibis, disguised under the guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide wars fought for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by attacks upon the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons filled with capacity citizens. In the times for the master thief, combine and conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential fame. At the table, then you're probably on the menu. We got the